Hello, and welcome to the Drama and Language Teaching Podcast. This is a podcast for teachers, practitioners, and researchers, and anyone else interested in the intersections between drama and theater and language teaching and learning. My name is Stephanie Giebert. I'm the host and producer of this podcast. Hello, Erika and Fiona. Thank you for being my guests on this podcast episode. I usually always start with my guests introducing themselves. So this time I have two guests. And I don't know, do you want to go alphabetically? Then I would ask Erika maybe to introduce herself first. So what's your background and where do you currently work, if that's okay with you?
Hello, Stephanie, and thank you so much for inviting us on the podcast today. So my name is Erika Piazzoli, and I am a lecturer in arts education at Trinity College Dublin, the University of Dublin.
Thank you very much.
And I'm Fiona Diel. I'm originally from the UK, but now based in Italy, teaching English language and translation at the University of Padova in Northern Italy.
Okay, thank you very much. And I invited you on the podcast actually to talk about a joint project that you've done. I hope I pronounced this correctly, the Sorgente project. And I heard about this project before. I've heard about it at conferences and also I've heard it mentioned by other drama practitioners and researchers. Could you tell me a bit, maybe briefly, what the project is about? And then also where it originated, how it came about.
Shall I sort of start at the beginning of the Italian part of the story? Because we can really go right back to 2017. And that was the year when I invited Erika to come and spend a month in Padova as a visiting scholar. And this just really serendipity, it coincided with a new project called Cultura Accoglienza at the university, where the university invited a group of asylum seekers. There were 30 particularly motivated asylum seekers living in the city. They invited them into the university to get a taste of university life. They went to Italian courses. They were shown around the libraries. They were shown around the resources of the university. And as I knew Erika was coming, I suggested, well, how about a drama workshop for this group? And that's where our kind of work with migrants, in this case, trying to learn Italian as a second language, that originated. And this led also then, as I think Erika can add the next piece of the story, to the Sorgente project,
which I think involved several locations, countries.
Yeah, so exactly. So what happened then? So we're back in 2017. We worked on that project. It was really fulfilling, and we felt our souls were enriched, and we felt there was a good synergy with the participants, but we also felt it was too short. Okay, it was really short, and it kind of gave us the idea to then continue and extend this work further across two locations. So in Padova still, but also in Dublin, where I'm based. So we looked at different options, and we decided that the best one would be to do a multiple case study with the two locations. So that took a bit of organization. And in the end, by the time we had the fundings in place from the Irish Research Council and we were ready to go, it was March 2020.
Okay, so a couple years later, actually.
Yes. Yeah, right at the wrong time. And I actually came over to Dublin for a training session in January 2020. And, you know, everybody was starting talking about this COVID, and we just thought, you know, that's, you know, just going to blow over. That's not going to affect us in any way. But that was also, as we'll see maybe later, one of the kind of major features of the, you know, sort of one of the things that had the greatest impact on the project at the start anyway.
Okay. And so there were two universities involved. Were there any other collaborators on the project?
Yeah, so it took a few years because we spent a lot of time putting together a team and then looking for the right partners that could work with us, community partners. So we had 10 team members in our project. It was myself and Fiona, of course. Then Elif Kirkallen from Turkey was also there. Luca Marucci from Ireland, Italy and Ireland. Gareth Scully from Ireland, England,
Germany,
Germany, and beyond. Kathleen Werner-Yates from Flying Turtle Productions in Ireland. Miriam Stewart, also from Flying Turtle Productions in Ireland, and Embodied Grammar facilitator. Rachel Jacobs from Western Sydney University in Australia. Anna Ciobanica, from France, and also then, well, from Ireland, then she relocated to France, and Ashley McNally from Ireland. So it was quite a number of us. And originally in February 2020, we all convened at the same time with the idea to take turns and facilitate the practice together in Dublin to begin with. So we had it all set out for the Australian collaborator, Rachel, to come over in Dublin. And Fiona already said she come and she was going to come back, and Garrett and the others. We also had three community partners that made it possible for us to work with the young people. Two were based in Ireland and one was based in Padua. I'll talk about the Irish ones. So the first one was Yes for Refugees and Migrants, Youth and Education Services. That's the Yes for Refugees and Migrants, a service administered by the City of Dublin Education and Training Board. And so basically this partner works with young people who are recently arrived in Ireland. And what they do is they have this program called the Migrant Access Program, where they help new arrivals to prepare for schooling. So it's a 1 or 2 years program where they work with the young people there, and they provide whatever is needed so that then they can be integrated in the schooling system. And the second partner that we had was Youth Reach, who is also government-funded a service in Ireland that works with early school leavers. So those individuals that for some reason have dropped out of school and then want to go back to education to get a professional qualification or to go back to schooling. And within the Youth Reach is had several branches, more than 100 branches across Ireland. But we were working with one of the branches whose profile is very high in migrants and asylum seekers. So these were the two partners that we had here in Ireland. And Fiona, can you talk about the third
Yes,
partner?
I mean, I was working with an NGO based here in Padova called Razzismo Stop, which, as you can tell by the name, aims to fight racism in its various forms. The organization works a lot with schools. It gives individual advice to migrants, to asylum seekers. But one of their activities, which has been going on for a long time, is teaching Italian. On a kind of drop-in basis, an after-school help for people who need it, young people who need it, but also adult education, anybody who wants to come and learn some Italian. So I had two collaborators there, Marzio Sturaro, who we call our sort of head of the school. He's one of the main coordinators of Razzismo Stop. And also I was working with Martina Giacchetti from University of Padova, who had recently completed her master's on learning languages with drama. So ours wasn't just, I mean, we had a wide range of participants. Once again, these sessions that we'll talk about later, the performative language learning, they took in and took place with a kind of drop-in basis. It was held in a community center. So we did have participants from 17 to 50 years old, so a big wide range, and anybody could come. The policy with the group was they never asked anything about people's status, background. It's just come and learn Italian. And so this, also, was is a challenge because you get a wide, very wide variety of people dropping in to have the classes.
So it's not always the same people, but
I mean, they tend to, have a core group forming, and then around the core group, you'll have people who may pop in for one lesson. But yeah, within the core group itself, you did have this big, as I said, we had a 17-year-old and somebody in their 50s.
Okay, wide variety of age
Ages,
and backgrounds.
backgrounds, yeah. Whereas for us, especially for the first case study, it was more of a formal education setting. So the workshops were timetabled within the students' learning. There's the students' classes that were timetabled, their English as a second language, hours of morning classes. And so the manager of the migrant migrant access program, Jessica Farnan, she sort of put together for us. She created a group of students that seemed to be suitable in terms of language levels, but also openness and suitability to this kind of project. So we were presented with a group of students who we worked with for 16 hours. That was case study one. So in a formal learning situation. In case study two, the youth reach students, what happened is by the time we were ready to work with them, and that was 18 months after the initial training, so in the spring of 21, the students had just finished their academic year, and so we weren't timetabled within their classes, but we designed this intervention as a summer school, as an intensive 5-day summer school that took place in their first week of holidays. So it was an open participation, as you can imagine, like 9 to 5 p.m. on your first week of holidays. It was a long shot. And so we had 18 students to begin with, but not everybody was a constant in their attendance. So we had about, like Fiona was saying, some that would that were always there, and about 6 to 10 who continued to come back and were always present, and the others were floating. So out of 18, some were floating. And I suppose with case studies, each one is like a microcosm. We had these differences in terms of the frequency as well, because in the first case study, it was basically from April to June. The commitment was 1 or 2 hours per week in a timetabled setting. So the students could opt out if they wanted, but really it was happening in their classroom during schooling hours. In the second case study, it was an intensive 5 days, and it wasn't even in the school because we had to observe social distancing. So we had to move in a different center, which was new to the students. And in Padova, again, it was different because it was happening. Well, like Fiona said, was it a weekly basis, Fiona? The Yeah,
commitment.
ours was on a weekly
On a
basis.
weekly basis as well.
Yes.
So your research approach was case studies, if I understand it correctly. So you're not looking for any sort of comparison between the groups, but each group was its own microcosm, as you said.
Absolutely, yes. So I think also importantly, it's a really good point that you mentioned, Steffi. We made this important, we acknowledged that we wouldn't compare, and it wouldn't be right to compare because, for example, in case study one, we had young people between 15 and 17 year old, most of whom were unaccompanied minors, and all of them were in the process of getting or have been granted refugee status. In the second case study, it was young people over 18, and some were migrants, not all of them had refugee status. And in the third case study, like Fiona was saying earlier, it was a much wider the age group. And it was not, their status was not disclosed. So we were very reluctant to compare. Also, nationalities were different, very different. We had Somalia, Afghanistan, Congo in case study one, Afghanistan, Eritrea, Kenya, Iran, Moldavia, Nigeria, Romania, and Sudan in case study two. And case study three was China, Kosovo, Libya, Nigeria, Peru, Venezuela, and Albania. And each person is their own microcosm in a way. Let alone that we're sort of grouping them together into case studies because they all shared the experience of the practice, but we didn't feel it was appropriate to compare the case studies themselves.
Thank you. Yeah. Okay. So I think, yeah, this answered my question about who the language learners were. You mentioned language level, but I would guess that, again, there was some variety.
Yeah, I mean, in my group, it really did go. It went from A1 to B2. There was one participant whose Italian really was pretty good, but she loved coming to this community center, and she was very much a kind of helper as well as a learner. But although she was always very, very keen to pick up new things, so. And, you know, some students who'd been in Italy for a very short amount of time. So, yeah, there was this huge, huge difference in levels.
And likewise, we had, so on paper, we had a B1 requirement, but it ranged from A2 to B2.
Yeah, as a kind of normal problem.
Yeah. It's never all this is arbitrary, and you know, also literacy of these individuals shifted and varied greatly. So
okay, now we know who was involved in the project. Could you tell me something about what I would maybe say the building blocks of the project? So the practice, the interventions that you did?
Yeah. Fiona, do you want to answer this or shall I?
Well, you can start and then I shall jump in.
Okay, so we spoke about the team before, and I suppose something that we all shared was this practice-based approach to teaching and learning, so performative language pedagogy, if you like. So drawing on the performative arts to facilitate learning, what was we had in common. And nevertheless, you know, it's such a big umbrella term and we all had our unique trainings. So what we ended up doing in the case studies, the Irish case studies one and two, was offering a combination of different practitioners' expertise in actor voice training. That was Kathleen's expertise, as well as embodied grammar from Miriam, myself in process drama, Luca in process music, and that was it, I think. Yeah, and so we also had, I should say, Aisling, who sketched these performances live. So her expertise was the visual arts. So she was drawing key specific moments in the practice that I just discussed above. So
it was a wider range than just theater, but music and visual arts.
Theater
involved.
Was the common denominator, but we had definitely improvisation, different approaches to theater, from devising to improvisation, as well as actor voice coaching.
Yeah, I mean, in our case, it was slightly different because there were the three of us, and Marzio, who's had when he was an ex high school teacher. And he's been involved in these Italian courses for a long time, but he hadn't got the drama background. And Martina and myself. So there were just the three of us. So it was basically a embodied language, embodied grammar, plus a bit of very, very structured, simplified process drama, given the sort of some of the low levels involved, a lot of drama games, improvisation, and a lot of opportunities for the participants themselves to set the agenda, because as we weren't in this formal structure and they were coming to improve what they felt were, you know, their needs in the Italian language. So we did really have to be very open and flexible to, you know, what they felt they needed, they wanted. A lot of this was some kind of, you know, vocabulary work. So we tried to incorporate this into, you know, embodied approaches as far as possible.
And just maybe one quick question that I didn't put on my list before, but did your participants have any theater backgrounds? I mean, maybe some of them or none of them?
Not in my case, no.
In our situation, the first case study, yes, for refugees and migrants, they did not have, that I'm aware of, they didn't have any drama experience. In the second case study, however, the youth-rich folks, they had worked for the whole term on, I think they called it a non-verbal communication mode. So basically the connection through that case study came about because their drama teacher was very interested to be involved in this project. So Tony Ferns, Ento, how the students called him. And so, yeah, so they had some experience in drama, and we could see the difference straight away. Or also be older than the other kids.
Okay. I would move on now to ask you about some of the challenges you experienced in the project. I guess with the pandemic, you've already mentioned one big challenge, I guess, but there might have been others.
So the pandemic, if the pandemic were a box and we opened it, what we'd find is very many different challenges related to it. The first one was that we signed the book contract in March 2020, and we were supposed to begin the fieldwork at that time. The fieldwork was stalled for 18 months. And so, you know, that also had repercussions on the editorial project that was related to it. We also had another challenge, which was we conducted this workshop in February 2020, and some teachers had signed up, and we interviewed them already. We had already conducted some 20 hours of observation on the site. And so then we couldn't use the data related to the observation in the schools, because by the time we were invited back, we were allowed back, the students had moved on and graduated.
Mm-hmm.
So the teachers who had signed up with us, whom we had interviewed, moved on to other jobs or were no longer in a position to be involved at the time. What else in terms of challenges? Well, the team, of course, we had arranged flights and accommodation for the team, and everything was cancelled. Flight, you know, travel was not allowed. So there was a lot of changes there and some tears. But ultimately, we could, some of our team members could not be there for the practice, which meant they felt it was even more important for them to understand what was going on. So that's why we had two facilitators in the room and then a third facilitator observing and writing very specific notes, and then the visual artist sketching. Another challenge that we had was that.
Just very quickly interrupt. Sure. So it was all face-to-face. So you didn't switch to anything
so
online.
So we switched to online for another project, but just so that we don't confuse the people listening, we'll stick to the Sorgente project. We waited for the school to reopen, and that was April 2021.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So when we arrived and we were able to access the site, we were the first people to walk back in the school, like outsiders from the school. And the students had only been back to face-to-face for a couple of weeks. So the challenges we had then were of a different texture.
Mm-hmm.
We had social anxiety, isolation, you know, basically the legacy of being online for all that time, you know, 18 months is a very long time. And also we had things like desks had to be separated, and we
Oh,
had
yeah.
to sanitize, all the props various times, and we had to wear masks, which wasn't so good for things like voice training. And also sometimes the students would speak really softly, quietly. And with the masks, it was harder for us. We were recording, and recordings were muffled because of the masks. I suppose, there was that very pragmatic side of things. But ultimately, it was a time where people were feeling still a bit cautious and anxious to, being in a group. And so we felt at the beginning that it was we felt this this energy, this sort of caution around being together in the same time. But on the other side, we all thrived in the energy and the presence of being with each other's bodies in space. And this was something that was shared by all, by the team, by the students, by the staff. Just coming back together after a very long period of hibernation, was, I suppose, not a challenge, but also something that you had to contain, because we couldn't just jump up and down and go, oh my God, we're in the room. We actually had to focus that as well. So, coming back to the challenges. What about you, Fiona? What did
Yes, I mean, it's a similar thing here. And I think you have this kind of, as we know, the post-COVID anxiety manifesting itself in very, very different ways. And, one of, as you'll come to now, one of our research themes was connected to laughter. But I did have, especially with the sort of younger members of my group, I had the gigglers. So we had these, people literally sort of collapsing into fits of giggles, which was, in many ways, it was a result of the activities themselves, but also I think combined to this kind of release of being there after a long time online and so on. In other cases, there was more reticence, and so I think you see both sides of the coin. People react in different ways. I think even amongst the practitioners, there was the same feeling of relief because it was it had been so hard, but at the same time, you were sort of stuck in the middle there. You knew what was going to happen. You had your masks on. You were still trying to find solutions, cope with things, things that we used to take for granted, with people sort of, virtually on top of one another, and there being a lot of physical contact, which was something you still had to be. You're doing your tableau vivant, but you're kind of getting people to do it.
With a
Okay,
distance.
we've come out of the distancing of 2020, but we still weren't to the point where people would actually be closely, sort of physically touching each other and things like this. So it was, yes, it was very much that sort of being in the middle time where you weren't sure what direction things would go in.
And may I go back, since I think you mentioned research questions, what were your overall research questions? So what were you interested in finding out? I'm guessing it was probably relatively open as you did case studies, but so what was the the theme you were looking for, the themes, the topics you were looking for?
So we had three research questions. The first one was related to research methods. And it goes, how can embodied research methods be used effectively in an arts-based educational research within the context of the study? So I think it's really important that we've talked about the context of the study first, because it's a huge part of the question. And if we started with the research questions, none of this would make sense. So, having discussed the context of the study, again, I'll repeat the question: how can embodied research methods be used effectively in arts-based educational research within the context of the study.
So it was both a project about teaching and learning, but also about research on teaching and learning, and
Absolutely.
both of
Yeah,
them
it was a
arts-based.
methodological question. The second one was about motivation to belong. So, how does motivation to belong relate to language learning in the context of the study? And Fiona, have you the third one there?
Yes, and the third one was how does performative language practice support an ethical imagination? That was the third one. So I don't know. I mean, there's a lot in there, and there's a lot that relates also to our practice. We mentioned broadly some of the activities, but two things which I think were fundamental, obviously there are others, to the whole project. One was the language portraits, and this was something which came into the project in many, many ways. So this idea of creating a translanguaging space, acknowledging, recognizing all the
Could
language
you,
discourse.
I'm not sure if all listeners are familiar with the language portrait. Could you give us a little bit of information about that?
Yes, so
How
sort
it
of,
works?
yes, take a couple of steps back. The language portrait is, okay, it's a way of helping researchers, but teachers, but learners become aware of their linguistic repertoires. Yes, but how does it work? Basically, it works with an outline of a figure, a person, which has to be colored in.
So it's on paper or
It's on a piece
on
of paper,
projected paper,
on a
yes.
piece of paper, common or garden piece of paper, which also, can be transferred to online environments because all you have to do is say to the person online, okay, take a piece of paper, take a pencil, just draw an outline of a person without anything. And then this outline is colored in whatever way you want, according to the languages. I won't say the languages that you speak, the languages which are part of your life in some way. So I could say, okay, my first language is English, and I've decided that the color, so the first choice is the color. So you choose the color I like for, I've chose for English is green. Now, sometimes the color choice is arbitrary. Sometimes there's a reason for it. It could be forests, it could be freedom, it could be, red as the heart and passion. And having chosen the color, you then color a part of the portrait, or maybe sort of the background to the portrait with this color. So you can find very simplistic things like, okay, I have a red heart and it's red. And that represents, Romanian, because that is my language, which is in my heart, and I color it there. You then have, you can have other languages, maybe a language that you speak a little bit, or a language you understand but you can't speak, a language that you would like to speak in the future, which is maybe colored outside this portrait. Or, you have two people choosing, stomachs and fingers and toes for various reasons.
So you find a place and a color for the languages
You
on
find
the
a place
portrait.
for the, yes, exactly. And the colors sort of can overlap, and the places overlap, and whatever. And this was something which we used in all the case studies. And it was something which, as I said, was related to the fact that even though, our aim was to enable the learners to improve, in Erica's case, their English, in my case, their Italian, we welcomed references to other languages as creating an environment in which people had something to give of themselves if they wanted to. So none of this, you can't say that, it's English only or it's Italian only. and how, you know, the participants colored in their language portraits was very revealing. And to find out more, you can read the chapter devoted to this, written by Eva and Elif in the publication. I don't know if you want to add anything, Erica, to this, because this could be a whole nother chapter, it could be, perhaps.
Yeah, and I'm thinking we could, yeah, this could go on for so long. So now all I wanted to say is that we had research themes, and one of the research themes addressing the first research question on embodied research methods is directly connected to the portraits. And the theme is language portraits as a multilingual activator. Because what happened is, after after carrying out this activity, our participants acknowledged the linguistic repertoires that they were bringing in the space. And we then, it wasn't just basically, oh, I can speak five languages, but it was also like mapping their biography on all sorts of levels. So it really helped, it became an activator to then take this value and make it our own in terms of the groups.
So that was one part of both a research method and also something, and a language, not a language learning activity per se, but an activity for the students, participants, to get to know each other, to find their place in the group, to get familiar with each other. And
And then, I mean, I don't know whether it's the right place to mention it here, because there are so many overlapping themes, but I think maybe, Erica, you need to say something about the Simurgh process drama, because that came into the project, and it came from you, and then it came to me, and it became a very, very important component.
Yeah, so the Simurgh, so first of all, Simurgh is a Persian word. The Simurgh process drama is the only process drama that we did in this particular context. And I'd like to start off by saying that, at least for the Irish case studies, none of this would have happened if we started off with the process drama. This needed to be scaffolded through the voice work, through the improvisation and the drama games, through the music. And then the process drama was the final thing we did after about 10 hours of practice, and similarly with the intensive after about 3 days. And the Simurgh process drama, first of all, what is Simurgh is a word that we've used a few times. So let's just say what it means for our listeners. So it's connected to a Persian myth of an old wise bird. And this bird is a bird that has always existed and knows the past, the future, and the present. And it has the claws of, it's represented many different ways, but usually with the claws of a lion and the head of a dog sometimes, or at the body of the peacock. Sometimes it's shaped also to resemble a whale. It's very powerful. It's a benign creature, female creature. Yes. Nests on the tree of knowledge in Mount Kaf, which is located say in Afghanistan. It's also, there's, it's debated, you know, the location, as everything in folklore and myth. So the story of the Simurgh became important to us because an overarching visual cue that we were using for the practice was coming from a publication called Migrations, Open Heart, Open Borders, which is a collection of drawings, animation, postcards, drawings, illustrations from various international artists across the world that depict birds connected to the theme of migration. So we were working with this collection, and one of the drawings within this collection depicted the Simurgh. So the drawing was from Amir Shabanipour, an Iranian graphic designer and illustrator. And when we were flicking through this book, Elif Kir, the Turkish collaborator, recognized the Simurg and shared with us the myth of the Simurg, through which we created the process Rama. So the story of the Simurg, there's so many different variations of the myth, but the one we ended up going for is one shared in an ancient text called the Conference of Birds. And in this particular text, the story of the Simurg is related as all the birds from all over the world were looking for a ruler, and they couldn't decide who would rule their world. So they decided to get together as a flock and fly to Mount Kaf and ask the Simurg who should be their ruler. And so it's basically a story, a lyric poem, where these birds fly through seven valleys, and each valley has an allegory connected to it. And by the time they arrive, there were very many, and then by the time they arrive, it's only 30 of them. But they can't find the Simurg anywhere, so they start to panic and get flustered because they've been flying for so long. And then ultimately they realize that the word Simurg in Persian is combined by two words, si and murg, which means 30 birds. So the group of birds who have endured the journey and hasn't given up is in fact the Simurg. So it kind of gets, you know, like a bit psychological there.
Yeah.
We shared this story with our participants up to the point where they can't find the Simurg. And then we created the different we explored these different possibilities related to the Simurg story, and then at the end of it we share the ending, and that is when the participants enroll as birds looking for the Simurg realize that they had been the experts, the knowledge holders for the whole time. So there is you know, a lot of work in terms of symbol, ritual, and metaphor that comes in related to the drama.
And so I gather you did the process drama in both locations because Fiona said it came to her.
So. Yes, it was, you know, after sort of coming out of this conversation with Eric and Elif, I once again, you know, after a lot of scaffolding, a lot of games, a lot of improvisation, vocabulary work, embodied grammar, and so on, we, in the last few meetings, we engaged in the Simurg process drama, and there was a lot of, you know, we were in a community centre, so the whole, you know, idea of the community kept coming up, and we had conversations about, you know, where you felt, you know, where they felt they belong, which groups they belong to. And in fact, in the end, the group as a group wrote down their version of the story, giving it, you know, a message, a motto, and their motto was, you know, we are the ones who build our lives, but we have to work together. They wrote this in Italian. I've just translated it into English. And so this really struck a chord with what then we were interested in investigating, this idea of motivation to belong and the idea of what actually do we mean by belonging and feeling that you belong somewhere in one particular place to some kind of community, or, you know, even thinking of this is the importance of performative approaches in creating the class as a community itself, to which people feel that they belong and feel that then this sort of ties in with another a theme, feels that they can take the risks needed to learn the language despite all the challenges of learning any language, basically.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be a very multi-layered story, and probably very, very complex, and the learnings and the associations that come up. So I'm sure that's also something you probably talk about for hours.
We could talk about it for hours, but there's something that I want to come back to. So in our case studies, something that the participants' feedback related to the project was how these experience, and they were saying this just after the Seymour Processorama, helped them to develop a sense of team building. Mm-hmm. And then some of the participants mentioned leadership skills, how it helped them to develop a sense of leadership skills and leading a team. So them, perhaps doing group work or negotiating group dynamics.
Within the project then?
Within the project, but they were talking not only about the benefits of this mm-hmm. approach. What did they get,
That they could apply outside the project.
That's right.
Well.
So there was a lot of talk about team building, and we weren't really expecting that, to be honest, and also leadership.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just two things that kind of came to my mind hearing the story. Of course, this idea about you are the experts, kind of the dynamics between looking for a wise person and then actually realizing that you have the wisdom yourself. That's an interesting topic in a classroom. But also one thing that kind of struck me was you said that not all the birds made it, apparently. So that's also kind of interesting aspect, facet. But yeah, probably too many things to talk about.
It is really, so that goes back to the original piece from the Conversation of Birds by Attar, Farid Attar, written in the 12th century, by the way. So it's like, it's basically, a piece of literature that we really looked up to. And not all the birds made it, but in the story, the protagonists of the tale are the survivors. So when we started the process drama, we framed it so that they were the ones who were going to reach Mount Calf. And in fact, there was a teacher in role strategy episode whereby I was in role as the lost bird.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to the flock, I'm not going to make it. I was the one who wasn't going to make mm-hmm. it. And the birds had to work together to convince me that I could continue the journey. So I really wanted to just sit in a corner and get them to move on and feel sorry about myself. And since then I've recreated this drama probably a dozen times, and I'm always trying to persuade the flock that I want to rest and I don't want to continue. And the flock always has to basically find ways to persuade me to continue. And this is it. This is when I suppose the team building, the leadership, because I'm genuine in my improvisation. As I say, I don't think I can make it. Leave me behind. And I'm yet to find someone says, oh yeah, we'll leave you behind. But then ultimately as a flock, as a community, they find ways, in the last iteration, they had some fabric cloth, and then they used the fabric to create like some forms of bandage because I had injured my wing in the story. So yeah, not all the birds make it, but I think if we go back to the experience of migration and seeking refuge and seeking asylum, the participants that we have in the space are those who have made the journey, who have witnessed sometimes really difficult situations and atrocious crimes and murder, but they are there, they have made it. So I think it is important to realize that their resilience is stronger, that mm-hmm. their potential sense of not being able to make it in the host community, because they have effectively, got here.
Probably on many it's different levels.
Absolutely. Yeah,
the message for the host communities as well, who tend to sort of, put people in their sort of situation of a victim rather than realizing this, that the agency that there is there already. I mean, this idea of we need to give people more agency. No, I mean, the agency is there. You just have to hook into it, or, you know, help people to realize that, or give people situations where they can make their own choices. And I think, Eric, if you remember, in that very first workshop we did in 2017, this was something which came up when one of the participants said, well, normally, you know, I go to these classes and all I do is answer a question. Mm. And here I can actually, you know, I can create something myself rather than just being on the, you know, being the respondent, which is very, very important.
Absolutely. And this idea of rejecting the victimhood, the identity of the victim, was very much something we discussed at the start, and that informed all our decision making and the choice of activities we did, the choice of presentation, the choice of frameworks for analysis as well. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And probably also this kind of journey, probably also associated with the language learning journey, because maybe sometimes you want to give up, and well, maybe exactly. If you're in a good learning community, they can convince you to,
yeah,
to not give up.
Something that I'd like to mention related to this. So we used zines, this form of collage, to get students to reflect on their learning. And one of the prompts we had was, if you had to speak to somebody who wants to begin studying English, that was for the Irish case studies, mm-hmm. what would you say? So, and then they had to use collage and drawing to answer that question. And it's an interesting question because it flips the situation, so that the participants, even if their English was still developing, say it was, you know, a B1 on paper, maybe a B2, but really an A2, they were answering it as a student of English that had already been studying English for a long time, maybe, and that was already operating within the English context because they were living in Ireland at the time. And they were addressing an imaginary student from their own country who had never studied English. So we positioned them as the language learning expert of the pair. And that was very much, you know, something that from the beginning we made very clear, you know, you are on your language learning journey, and wherever you are, we value your experience and your expertise. So there, they were basically through the collage, they were giving all these suggestions to this imaginary friend who wanted to start learning English. And that very much goes back to taps into the core values of drama in education related to reversing the hierarchy of the expert mm-hmm. that you mentioned before.
And you did already mention that your participants in their feedback mentioned these team building skills that they gained. What other feedback did you get from participants?
So the feedback was related very much to being together, presence, being together in a space, you know. So it was all very much like a post-COVID, post-lockdown feedback related to the importance of being together in space. We also got feedback related to the language learning experiences, so how beneficial it was to focus on pronunciation, vocalization, resonance, and we called it like a gym for language learning, you know, related to all the exercises. So that was hugely important for the students. And then as soon as we introduced nonverbals and, you know, improvisations, then the students appreciated the possibility of creation and the laughter as well. Mm-hmm. So the fun infused in the learning was important.
Fiona, would you like to add anything?
I think the only thing to add to that was this, as I said before, this idea of, you know, building the group as a community of people who'd come together to learn, and, you know, people who were setting their own agendas. And also, I mean, I think what I had in my case, which is slightly different, you know, with the older members of the group, you had people who could get by pretty well with their Italian, but they obviously wanted something more. And I think that's why the creativity of this approach was beneficial, because they could find what they really were looking for, what they wanted to express, rather than just being told this is what you need, because in many ways they didn't actually need anything. People who had a full-time job and had been living in Italy for quite some time, but it's what they wanted just for personal satisfaction, for I think another thing which related to the voice, the words themselves, the joy of just, feeling a new word on your lips, on your tongue, in the air around you.
Yeah, which reminds me very much of Professor Manfred Scheu's idea when he talks about form and aesthetic form in language and performative language approaches being able to tap into form and the beauty of language. So that sense of aesthetic form, which helps us to connect on a different level, on an aesthetic level with the language itself.
Then, having talked about the participants' feedback, I'd like to ask you now about what did you find in terms of research findings in the study? So what were the outcomes here?
Yeah, so we could be here for another
For a
hour.
long time.
It's a very But just to sum it up, so we used reflexive thematic analysis to analyze the data, and we generated nine themes.
And the data was gathered by interviews and by sketching
Yeah, so thank you. The data was gathered by
of
a variety of
videos.
means. So we couldn't video
Oh, okay.
because we didn't have permission to video these participants. Therefore, we brought in a visual artist who sketched key moments. That's for the Irish case studies, who sketched key moments. And then we used those drawings, those gesture drawings, to prompt the participants to remember
In
key
the
moments.
interviews, then.
So we audio recorded those conversations. We audio recorded most of the lessons. We had an observer in class who took very detailed, vivid notes of what was happening. We also had reflective journals. What else did we do? The language portraits were considered as a data set that we discussed before, the
That Fiona
silhouettes that you
described,
color
yes.
in, with the collage. So the zines were also part of the data sets. And so we had three research questions that we mentioned before. And for each question, we had three themes that we
So the
generated.
nine themes all in all.
Exactly, that encapsulated what we looked at. And those were related to, in terms of the first question, which was really a methodological question about embodied research methods, we found that the zines and the making of those zines, those collage activities, acted as a catalyst for us to reflect on and build upon shared values. And for us as a team, as a team, our values were related to the multilingual ideology of teaching and learning and performative means in teaching and learning. Then we also found that the language portraits acted as a multilingual activator that we already discussed. And then the gesture drawings. So those drawings, they really function as a tool to activate collective embodied knowledge. They weren't just a means to gather and to reproduce what was happening. It wasn't like taking a picture. The artist selected the key moments based on her own gut feeling, and then she shared them with the group. The group used the drawings to recollect vocabulary, but also to recollect drama the scenarios, right, the experiences, the improvisations, as well as in the Seymour process drama, the various parts of the drama. And so then there was, you know, it acted as a pedagogical tool in terms of the recollection of the vocabulary, but mm-hmm. also then as a narrative tool to recreate and scaffold the narrative. But it also helped them to think about what they were doing, to see themselves from a distance perspective through the sketches. So that was very much related to the embodied knowledge and in the embodied research methods. In terms of the second cluster of findings, so related to the belonging question, Fiona, do you want to have...
These are things that we've touched upon already, but we had the feeling safe in translanguaging. So, mm-hmm. you know, related to the portraits, but the idea of using all your different languages in various ways.
So that is basically the meaning of translanguaging for someone who's not familiar.
And once again, I mean, we could go on a long time, but it's the idea of using flexibly all your language resources. You know, it could be, it goes in a way beyond just sort of mixing languages. Mm. You could be listening in one language and then you turn to somebody and you speak in another language. You know, mm-hmm. you have a context in which different languages come into play in different ways. And so, you know, allowing for this to happen in the classroom was conducive to this feeling of safety.
Mm-hmm.
Then laughing together in creative collaboration, I think we've mentioned before that the laughter that emerged in the activities. Then also there was the theme being committed to learning, which mm-hmm. once again was related to the learner's agency, the learner's sort of taking learning, you know, responsibility, you know, for what they wanted to learn, and mm-hmm. taking it into their own hands. And then, Erica, the ethical imagination, maybe you could move back to that, to you.
Absolutely.
That because
so... The third research question was related to the ethical imagination, which was something that ties back to what we were saying before. So the idea of rejecting the victimhood identity of our participants. And that was really important to us because very often in these settings, educational settings, you have artists or teachers who have an interest in the arts, artists that have an interest in education who come in sometimes through partnerships or sometimes solo, and they want to do something creative, artistic with these groups, but mm-hmm. they perhaps end up triggering past trauma
mm-hmm.
or coming from a place where they feel that the participants have to be rescued or fixed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or the wine night syndrome. So we just wanted to make sure that we considered some ethical guidelines. Mm-hmm. And we noted in the literature review that preceded the fieldwork for the study, we noted that every project, that at least solid project that works in this context, puts forth like a code of ethics.
Mm-hmm.
Almost, you know, so we looked at those and we made a synthesis. And then in terms of the themes, the research themes that emerged for us, it was one related to aesthetic distance. So making sure that we work through a safe level of distancing. We don't ask the participants to relive their stories. Mm. But for example, the myth of the Simurgh is basically a story of migration. Mm. It's birds migrating, but it's not directly connected. We're asking the participants to relive their experience of leaving their home country. And so, you know, we felt that there was that sense of aesthetic distance there. Mm. Feeling at home at the threshold is how we decided to frame and phrase this theme. If you are intrigued, read the research report or the book where we discuss that in more detail. Then in terms of the second theme within the third cluster, we looked at trauma-informed approaches.
Okay.
And we looked at how trauma-informed approaches to teaching and learning could be helpful for performative language practitioners. And so we ended up analyzing the various findings through a trauma-informed practice, language practice. And then finally, we looked at brave spaces. So moments of co-presence, as in aesthetic engagement, where we felt that there were peak moments of emotion and of and of shared presence, really. And we looked at those, and we looked at how they informed brave spaces in the work.
So for people not familiar, I mean, we always talk about safe spaces, but brave spaces are a little
what are they?
More recent.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So the concept of brave spaces, like from an academic point of view, was introduced 10 years ago, 11 years ago, really, 2013, by Arau and Clements. So they published an article where they were evaluating what went wrong in a workshop that they had given, which in itself I think is very brave, you know.
Absolutely.
Like lots of things go wrong all the time, and you know as well, because you know, it's just, if you're improvising, that it's bound to be, you know, disaster is always around the corner, but the best lessons come from it. So anyway, so these two, Arau and Clements, they published an academic article to evaluate what went wrong in their practice, because the participants complained they did not feel safe. So then they started to unpack the idea of safety, and they noticed that sometimes if you say that a place is like, you want to establish a safe space, then, you know, what it also occasionally means is that you kind of stifle your open discourse, impeding growth and critical thinking, and I'm quoting them directly. And so they coined the notion of brave spaces. Here they were paraphrasing another academic who in 1998, Boost Rom, he wrote about safe spaces. So we talk about safe spaces a lot, and that's, you know, safe space is the concept originally associated to Rom. And so Rom, back in 1998, had written, "A person can learn, says Socrates, if he is brave and does not tire of the search." And now Socrates is quoting Plato. So we go back to Plato. Because we have to be brave, because along the way, we're going to be vulnerable and exposed. So then Arau and Clements, quoting Socrates, who quoted Plato, take the idea of brave spaces to acknowledge that the learning process can be challenging. And it doesn't have to be watered down or sugar-coated. So they called in their paper for the need for courage rather than the illusion for safety.
Okay.
Then this was then picked up at policy level and explored by other scholars. And ultimately, we felt that it was important for us, because with our groups, we needed to establish a safe space without which none of the learning would have happened. Especially because the learning, you know, the activities that we engaged them in were not, you know, perceived as safe to begin with. You know, what was safe was to sit down and listen and answer that question. But yeah, we were asking them to, you know, to put the desks in a corner, to stand up, to, you know, embody things. And that was, you know, for some of them, really out there. And then, so in order to look at safe space as a place where you feel safe enough to take a creative risk, then, you know, that was a whole journey that we analyzed and mapped out. And in the end, we found that there were instances where we were able to create co-presence through brave spaces. And we looked at what that entailed. So that is
I think I don't know where I read it, probably social media, but something along the lines of learning doesn't happen in the comfort zone.
Totally. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, you have it there. It's exactly that, you know. But then if you take that and you applied to learners who have been exposed to potentially traumatic situations, they need to be in the comfort zone, because if they go out of it, they may find it too challenging, and so they may start to display symptoms of, trauma survivors. They must be in their comfort zone. So is that pull and push, between this idea of coming out of the comfort zone, but being safe enough to do so. So it, that's the word that, the
Quite a
idea of,
challenge,
being
yes.
brave. Did you want to add anything to this,
No, I
Fiona?
mean, I think it's, this also, and it all ties in with, the whole kind of rejection of spoon feeding. And I think, I mean, it all kind of aligns with what we've been doing and what we believe, as regards language learning and autonomy and people taking responsibility for their own language. And, the risk that, yes, by saying you've got to create a safe space, it's not the space where you take the initiatives. And I think that's it. I know, I think in this quote that you were reading from before was this idea of, yes, this sugar-coated learning process, these little, nuggets of learning. And I think this is maybe all, in today's, in our day and age now, it's all the more urgent to, and I mean, creativity itself, and we're talking about many facets of creativity in using drama performative approaches. And yes, it just, being spoon-fed things and not being proactive isn't, it doesn't fit with our approaches. Which doesn't mean rejecting the idea of safety, though, obviously, because
One is integral to the other. You can't just jump in straight into brave spaces. And that's what relates to what I was saying before. If you go straight for the process drama
You talk about
without having done,
scaffolding.
your drama games, your voice warm-ups, your scaffolding, your improvisation, it's bound not to work unless you are working with a group that is very experienced in drama work, and it's a group that feels ready to go, which was that's certainly not what we had there.
But overall, it was a journey, and a journey where people definitely got a lot out of it, as far as I understand, both the learners and the researchers. And now, if people are curious to find out more details, so there is, I understood, a book publication and also a research report. Would you maybe like to talk about that briefly?
So the research report is freely available online, and it's called Sorgente, the Irish Case Studies, and as the name suggests, only covers the Irish case
The Irish
studies.
part.
So it's not comprehensive. So it's a good start. It's also free of charge, and it certainly gives a good overview of the project, including the Padova case study, because it shares, the design is similar in terms of the research design, the research questions, the themes. Very much so. However, for those readers who are interested in looking at the full picture, the book itself would be more beneficial. Have you got the book there, Fiona? Yes, I was seeing that you got the book there on your desk.
I've actually got the report there. I haven't got the book sitting on my
Okay.
desk, but
Well, I
the
can
book
definitely
is
put the link to
for,
the
because I
report.
have the website open here, Performative Language Learning with Refugees and Migrants, Embodied Research and Practice in the Sorgente Project, published by Routledge, published this year. And, Erica mentioned the collaborators. I think I could maybe a quick mention of the authors. We have, as well as ourselves as editors and chapter writers, we've got chapter on zines by Autumn Brown. We've got Eva Guskell and Eilif Kir Cullen on language portraits, Rachel Jacobs on the observational sketching, Luca Marucci on process drama, Miriam Stewart on a sensory account of language learning, body voice improvisation, Kathleen Warner Yates, co-present in Brave Spaces by Garrett Scally. I think that is it, right?
And I can put the link to the publishing house in the show notes.
Just
the link
just
to
a
the
wee
report.
Correction. So Luca Marucci on process music.
What did I say?
Drama.
I was
no problems. Yeah. And so also Shalette, so Fiona then has a chapter on motivation to belong. And then Erica
has a chapter on arts-based methodology, embodied methods, and also at the threshold of the ethical imagination. And we have the poem and the painting as a conclusion in there as well, and performative language practice in our introductory chapter.
Right, because you did mention your data poem before we started this podcast. Would you like to fill me in on what that was?
So we mentioned the 9 research themes, and each theme is very complex. And in the research report, each theme is allocated a chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the book, each theme is basically covered also by a chapter.
Mm-hmm.
But we felt that it was more important. So this is the perfect example. We can't tell you all about the theme because you'd have to read the chapter and it's too long and it's not possible. So what we thought we could do is we would capture the theme through one sentence spoken by either a participant, an observer, or an author in the literature. And so for each theme, we selected one sentence, one quotation, and we crafted those together to follow basically to become a poem.
Mm.
So the data poem, the title is itself very meaningful, Shades of Belonging. And then each verse is related to a theme. And in the report, each theme is fleshed out. And then at the end of the theme description, it just shares the verse and how it connects to the theme. And similarly, then in the book, this connection is quite transparent.
Mm-hmm. So again, you bring in the aesthetic level, basically.
Yeah. And I think ultimately what it comes down to is that when you can conduct research, but it's about how you disseminate it. How do you reach out to your audiences? And you can perform a poem. And even though the audience may not know who said what, and what every line actually means, if they are interested, they can then read on.
Mm.
But the poem in itself, on a different level, on an aesthetic way of knowing, may just connect to the listeners in a way that helps them to feel like they were part of the experience.
Mm-hmm.
Also because most of the lines are actually quotes from our very young people,
mm-hmm.
and participants, mm-hmm. Verbatim.
So there were people interested in the research, but maybe not researchers, might connect to the
exactly.
research through the poem.
Mm-hmm. Which is the ultimate goal,
mm-hmm.
that we wanted to, to make sure that the research was accessible.
Mm-hmm.
So shall we read the poem out?
We read it to finish.
Yeah. Do you want to have a go, Fiona?
I start.
How do you want to?
I'll start with the first research question.
Okay.
Shades of belonging. I am part sound, part silence, the words on the page and the space between. Everything is language. Head, hands, heart, I fly and flow. Wherever you go becomes a part of you. It's like an artwork. It starts off simple, then builds from there.
belonging as a fish in the sky and the bird in the ocean, wiping away the tears from laughter. You can do everything. You can speak if you want to speak. Feeling at home at the threshold of candlelight perception, I'm fearless. I may look fragile, but I'm very brave.
Thank you so much. I think that's the perfect ending. Thank you so much for this very, very, detailed interview, but I think it was very, very exciting findings from your project. And I hope listeners will go and read at least the report. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much for inviting us. It's a great pleasure to be here with you. Absolutely.